We have students from Japan and Europe and the US, as well as students from across the African continent. And so many of them are really interested in imagining what the world looks like and thinking about, it isn't what the world would look like without U.S. leadership. I think U.S. must and should lead, or at least must and should be one of a group of leaders around the world. But I do think that an increasingly large group of MBA students and other graduate business school students, including American students, are thinking about how to redraw some of the balances in the world in ways that are more likely to yield the kinds of outcomes that they're looking for.
Welcome to Leaders Unplugged. Leaders Unplugged is real talk with the impactful, candid, honest, actionable, and fresh from behind the scenes. Presented to you by IMD and hosted by IMD's president, David Bach, and myself, Felix Seltner, founder of Remote Daily. On today's episode, we take you behind the scenes of the annual meeting of the Global Network of Advanced Management, or GNAM, an alliance of 33 business schools from around the world. This annual meeting took place in Monterrey, Mexico, and David, who was one of the founders of this network and is a member today with IMD, sat down at this gathering with two of his fellow deans of business schools. From South Africa, Catherine Duggan, the dean of the University of Cape Town Graduate School of Business, and from Canada, Darren Dell, the dean at the Sauder School of Business at the University of British Columbia. Now, David has known him for years and knew that they were going to talk unplugged about how to navigate the rapid global shifts that are happening and how it impacts them, their schools, and their way of leading. So David kicked off by asking Darren about how things are going in Canada coming out of a national election that was heavily influenced by the changing relationship to the neighbor in the south.
How are we doing? What's interesting is it truly came as a shock to Canada. If that's what I could relate, it's a bit of a surprise. This has been a neighbor to us that has been really besties for decades, hundreds of years even, you could argue. And a massive trading partner, connected in every way, people living on both sides of the border, and all of a sudden, not friends. And so I would say many in Canada have been a bit shocked and surprised and didn't see it coming. And so this has resulted in a bit more of a wake up to, you know, Canada needs to maybe diversify a bit. You know, over 80% of our trade is with the U.S. Mm. And so we need to think about, you know, how do we diversify and realize that maybe you can't always trust people next door. And that sounds hard, but in many ways it might be good for Canada. It's certainly woken up a bit of national pride. Mm. At the university, it's interestingly been pros and cons. So obviously there's the psychological effect of having this happen, and certainly costs in running the university, it's an issue with tariffs. But on the flip side, we actually are seeing a bit of a spike, a bump in applications and enrollment. People that were going to go to the U.S. for education or people in the U.S., are actually looking to Canada now as perhaps a nice option, given some of the buzz and the messaging that's coming out of the presidency right now. And so for us, it's been a bit of positive, I would actually say, in terms of enrollments, but certainly struggling with it in terms of what does it mean moving forward. We rely on the U.S. for defense. We rely on the U.S. for culture. We rely on the U.S. for much of our economy. And so when that's taken to some degree, you know, it affects all conversation and why it had such an impact on our election. Mm.
Catherine, South Africa, of course, another country where President Trump seems to have identified some issues that he wants to squabble over about the role of the white minority, and seems to have been influenced to some extent perhaps by Elon Musk in some of this. How have you and how have your colleagues process this? Again, historically, South Africa, a country that's been quite close to the United States, particularly since the end of apartheid. What does that look like now?
So South Africa's a really interestingly complex country. Among other things, I think the first thing that we have to remember is that South Africa has only been a full democracy since 1994. Prior to that, it was under sanction and it was a very different country. And the question about how exactly it's rebuilding itself into the future of the country and indeed leading a continent, which will eventually be much more centered in the world, including in terms of population, when we look at the U.S., it's been a very complicated relationship for a while. I would say that South Africa is an interesting place to be because, among other things, there is an uncertain relationship between an uncertain viewpoint. Technically speaking, we're neutral with regard to the situation in Ukraine with Russia. But in point of fact, the country has often taken a more Russia-leaning bias. But the Western Cape, which is where we are in Cape Town, is much more solidly on the pro-Ukrainian, pro-Europe side. And similarly with Israel and Palestine, South Africa has actually led the way in many respects in bringing Israel to the ICC and other things like that. And of course, we're on a continent which is itself very complex and has a very large number of active conflicts, as well as many of the minerals on which we all rely. So I think in terms of the large-scale geopolitical questions, South Africa is in a very interesting position, a very complex position. And I think internally inside South Africa, we haven't really figured out exactly how we're going to manage that. Well, obviously, in case you can't tell from my accent, I'm American. And so for me, there's another layer of complexity associated with being an American living in South Africa under current circumstances. Now, I will say, UCT, so my parent institution, the Faculty of Health Sciences in particular, is the largest recipient of NIH funding outside North America. And most of that funding was going not only to HIV/AIDS, but also to tuberculosis, because among other things, in populations which have high disease burdens, you tend to get a lot of not just tuberculosis, but the threat of drug-resistant tuberculosis. And that is one of the things that UCT has really developed global expertise on. One of the big risks as we're thinking about what the implications for the university, for the country are, is there are actually very serious implications for the world. As we reduce science funding, as we reduce funding for science in developing countries, there is a real risk that we will stop being able to track and prevent a global outbreak of drug-resistant tuberculosis in the same way that, you know, South Africa, or that we will, I'll start again. There's a real risk that we will be unable to prevent a global outbreak of drug-resistant tuberculosis. And if you want to have a sense of how central South Africa is to monitoring things, you might remember the Omicron strain of COVID. Omicron didn't start in South Africa, but it was discovered in South Africa. And that's because South Africa has an extraordinary public health system. And it is tracking things and it understands things. And so much of that is happening at UCT. And so much of the funding for those processes has relied on the NIH and can no longer rely on the NIH. So we're in a situation where either the government of South Africa, which of course is constrained in many, many ways, again, it needs to rebuild the country and to continue to rebuild the country. We have, unfortunately, the highest rate of inequality in the world. The question is, how can a government that's already under that kind of strain fill in and backfill some of the money that's being lost with the, you know, removal of NIH grants? So it is a big challenge, I think, for everybody.
And so how are your colleagues dealing with this? I mean, here, you know, your colleagues in the health sciences have done this extraordinary work that benefits not just South Africa, the continent as a whole, but arguably the whole world, in part by building these strong relationships, research relationships with the United States and funding from the U.S. government. And it just goes away one day to the next.
You know, I think like Darren, there is a way in which we're benefiting from this. But I think in the long term, there really is a growth that's associated with this. I think exactly as Darren said in Canada, we need to think about the ways in which we diversify our funding sources. We need to think about the ways in which we are more actively going out and raising money. But I think more than anything else, scientists not just scientists in South Africa, but including scientists in South Africa, are having to make active cases for the public benefit of the kind of science they do, which is something that perhaps they hadn't been having to do as publicly as they now do. I think the same is true of business schools. So although I don't have undergraduates in the way that Darren does, we are attracting more and more students from around the world. We have students from Japan and Europe and the US, as well as students from across the African continent. And so many of them are really interested in imagining what the world looks like and thinking about, it isn't what the world would look like without U.S. leadership. I think U.S. must and should lead, and or at least must and should be one of a group of leaders around the world. But I do think that an increasingly large group of MBA students and other graduate business school students, including American students, are thinking about how to redraw some of the balances in the world in ways that are more likely to yield the kinds of outcomes that they're looking for. And so that's really what we're seeing in our classes.
That's interesting. Both of you are describing something similar, right? A situation you didn't expect, relationships that you had counted on, but now realizing that there may be a silver lining and having to diversify sources of funding, assuming some more perhaps initiative and autonomy when it comes to policy, foreign policy, right?
And totally, to be honest, just sharpening what you do.
Yes.
I mean, when you've had it good for many years and, you know, things have come easy, You don't have to innovate as much, perhaps, or you don't have to think, well, what do we need here? What do we not need here? And so this is that kind of opportunity where you can sharpen operations. I think the example in health is very poignant, but I think it applies as well to business schools. And, you know, a little bit of push sometimes can be helpful.
It's also, there's a way in which it changes the confidence level. So there's a thing that I like to say to my students all the time. You need to know a little bit about video games to understand this, but I'll give you a little bit of context. When you play video games,
We're both good.
Okay, yes. Good. I'm glad. Actually, you're probably
Atari generation. Yes.
I know you're probably better than I am.
Overwatch.
I am not a great video game player, but I am. I love this metaphor. So yeah. So when you play a video game, you can choose what level you're going to play on. You can play on normal mode, you can play on easy mode, or you can play on hard mode. And you're doing the same thing, but if you are on easy mode, everything is easier, as it says. So what I like to tell my students is doing business in Africa is like playing video games on hard mode. And in some cases, being in places like Zimbabwe is like playing video games on God mode. So when you grow up in circumstances like that, you really have a sense of how to manage volatility. You have a sense of how to manage this extraordinarily complicated political environment. And I think one of the things that's been really exciting, both for me to see of students on the African continent, but also that every single one of the students that we get from elsewhere in the world says is African students who've grown up under these circumstances, hyperinflation, you know, thinking about politics every single day, they have a sense of how to manage under uncertain conditions that people who grew up like me in places like Chicago simply don't have inbuilt. We have to think through these things. And I think we're really seeing that with global leaders who have lived in very sort of manageable circumstances for a long time in places like Europe and the US, where we've had persistent low inflation for years until recently. We've had very predictable political systems and institutions, and all of a sudden they're finding themselves very much on the back foot. And I think this is one of the areas where people, not just in Africa, but Africa, parts of Latin America, parts of Asia, can really step in to say, actually, we know how to manage through uncertainty. And I think places like Canada and the US and Switzerland can really learn from those kinds of lessons. And this is one of the things that we see. As soon as we started getting a bit of inflation, African students, and particularly African chartered accountants, were in great demand because they know exactly how to manage inflation. 8% inflation does not worry anybody who grew up in Zimbabwe, whereas 8% inflation in some countries in Europe is a national crisis.
So how do you think about your role leading one of the country's premier business schools and helping current leaders, future leaders, make sense of what this uncertainty means for them?
So for me, I think it's two parts. And the first really doubles down on what you've said is, you know, how do you deal with uncertainty? How do you deal with ambiguity? The second part, I think, that we need to prepare students for, and maybe not in all countries, but I think we could always be better at it, is what happens when things don't work out? And I think most kids in a Western world context, you know, you play by the rules, you do well in school, you go to university, it all works out. And you may fail something here or there, but nobody ever really punches you hard. And, you know, the trite word that everyone uses is resilience. I don't want to use resilience. I just want to use the word fall down. You know, students, I think, are not used to falling down a lot. And so, you know, that's something I think we can help students with, besides the uncertainty, the ambiguity, is, well, what happens if the plan doesn't work? Do you have a plan B? Do you have a plan C? What are your contingencies? And you know, we haven't had to teach that perhaps as much as we should. And we haven't had to think about, well, what does that mean in terms of the various aspects of business, whether it's finance or marketing or, you know, human resources. But how do we prepare students for things that not only are ambiguous and uncertain, but they're going to fail at in a big way, and that they won't get what they wanted?
You know, it's funny because I think that our students are actually organically looking for this. Among other things, when they talk about wanting to have impact, when they talk about wanting to go into programs that are going to show them how to have impact, I think part of it is impact, but part of it is really perspective. I see this a lot in the Global South, because when we get students who are coming from places like Canada and the US and Germany, they've done absolutely everything right throughout their entire lives. They felt as though there's a very narrowly prescribed path for them. And they've always felt as though if they take one foot off the path, then there's just an infinite fall toward nothingness. And when they get out of the areas that they know, when they get out of the sort of contexts that they know, they, especially if they're then surrounded by people who have been in all sorts of other contexts, and in places where there are new challenges and new difficulties, they often see a new perspective, which gives them not only some tools for resilience and some tools to manage things, you know, when things don't work out the way they'd hoped, in part by talking to people who, you know, have faced some really serious setbacks, but it also gives them a much broader perspective in terms of what's important, what matters, what constitutes success. And I think that's such an important thing. I will say, one of the things that I've been hearing more and more as we talk about sustainability, and particularly as we talk about scope 3, is the need for us to reduce travel. And as somebody who works in one of the places which is furthest away from just about everybody.
Just about everywhere, yeah.
It's a long plane ride.
It's a long, long plane ride. It's a long way away, but it's so important. And it makes my blood run a little bit cold to think of a future where we can only go places by train, because I think that if we are only going places by train, then the kinds of places that we could conceivably see. So having Swiss students who are only able to, you know, realistically go to places that they can reach by train during their MBAs will prevent them from seeing what they can see in Cape Town. And similarly, my students, some of whom have, you know, never left the African continent, get so much out of coming to IMD, they get so much out of coming to Sauder, and it really opens their eyes, and not just in ways that make them think, why don't I come here, but in ways that make them think, how do I understand the way that this works so that I can rebuild my country? And I think reducing that kind of travel is such a risk, even though I absolutely acknowledge that if we're going to drive a more sustainable future, we have to find a solution. But I don't think the solution is by saying we have to absolutely lock down that kind of travel.
So I like the narrative. Let's put aside the sort of emissions piece about air travel. But I think the overarching narrative has been end of globalization, borders going up everywhere, everybody's turning inward, America first, first, right? And what you're saying is actually at this time, perhaps more than ever, we need to be connected, learn from one another.
I think universities have to play a role here to keep pushing that as an important solution to what the world sees as challenging.
It being the global connectedness.
It's a global connectedness. And I would hope that universities are not going to fold. I mean, you see Harvard stand versus perhaps other institutions. You know, if that's what we believe, and I know the three of us do, being part of this network, you know, then we have to be sure to stand up and say, you know, we need to make sure that that connection exists, that students are able to travel and see other cultures, other education systems, other problems, because that's just going to make for a better a better end game for all of us. So I do think very strongly that the universities around the world have to use voice and continue to push for this.
And of course, when universities use voice, they do that through their leaders. One of the things I've been thinking quite a bit about is that leaders are being called on right now to make sense of what seems unsettling. Yet at the same time, you may not have all the answers, right? We don't really know what the future of the Canadian economy is going to be. We don't know how that important research on tuberculosis is going to continue in Africa. So how do you deal with the expectation that students, that your faculty colleagues, that other stakeholders might have?
I mean, for me, I think it's being very clear on, you know, what are the values, what are the first principles that I look at in terms of managing the organization that I work in, and being true to what, you know, I think is important to building a place where students can learn, where they can feel safe, and where they can truly grow. Now, that sounds a little opaque, perhaps, but I think to make that really concrete is I try to push students to not think about things in a black and white sense that, oh my God, everything the U.S. is doing is terrible right now. It's just not true. There's some elements that you can point to say, well, that's interesting. Like maybe 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, they might have real value. And then there's other elements that, you know what, that's just the wrong way to go. Mm-hmm. And I can predict that that's going to end up badly. Or, wow, what an experiment. What's going to happen here? You know, as we all know, we polarize very quickly now. And so trying to tell students, look, stay firm on who you are and where you are and how you see things, but be open to trying to understand what's happening and see the positive and the negative and the potential as an opportunity. So easy to say, but that to me is the perspective that lets me sleep at night a little bit.
I mean, I used to work for a startup, and we started a new business school in Rwanda. And I think the thing that I really took away from that more than perhaps anything else is a sense of mission-driven, you know, what it means to be mission-driven. And I think that that's the ultimate way in which I would categorize myself as a leader. I wake up every single day, I'm committed to the African continent. I've been working in Africa, I've been thinking about Africa, I've been doing research on Africa for 25 years. And my entire professional career has been devoted to the African continent. And I have no idea if what I do in my life with Africa is going to make a difference, but I have to wake up every single day and believe that it might. And I think that if I can live that belief, if I can live that element of mission-drivenness, then people take that. Now, I mean, you can't eat being mission-driven, right? You can't use being mission-driven to pay your rent, and anybody who's worked for a startup knows that very well. But I do think that when we're thinking, exactly as Darren said, when we're thinking about this in terms of grand historical narratives, or even sort of relatively smaller historical narratives, if we're thinking about things in the course of the next 25 years, the question is, how can we pragmatically get through this to go where we're going? And I will say that I think that pragmatism is the most important thing, because sometimes if we fail to be sufficiently pragmatic, then we can shoot ourselves in the foot today in ways that will fundamentally alter our ability to get where we want to go. So if we really have a sense of this long-term goal, even if we don't know exactly what that long-term goal looks like, and that's what I try to do as a leader of our institution, to navigate you know, local politics as well as national and regional and global politics in ways that will allow us space to continue to be driven on this much larger mission that we're on.
That resonates with me, everything you said. One of the first things that got cut by Elon Musk and his Doge team was foreign aid in the U.S., USAID, of course, the continent.
Unbelievable.
There are a lot of commentators who believe that the retreat from the continent, particularly from humanitarian work on the continent of Africa, is going to yes, lead to a vacuum, things not happening, but also it creates opportunities for others to fill that. China, of course, being one prominent candidate, a country that has been quite active on the continent, investing heavily in infrastructure and so on. Are you seeing that? How does your pragmatism and your focus on moving the continent forward then interact with your values as an American committed to the continent's development, but presumably also to a set of institutions that you identify with?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of these things we have to think about how to invest literally and figuratively in each one of these areas. What I do like to tell people is the one thing that I know is I know the demographics. And the demographics say that, or at least they suggest, that given current birth rates, by 2050, in 25 years, which is, by the way, the time that our current MBA students are likely to be running big companies, by 2050, one quarter of the world's population will be African. And so what I like to tell my students is, if you believe that young people are where we get new ideas, where we get new markets, where we get new ways of thinking about things, then Africa could lead the world in this, or at least it could be at the center of this emerging market. And I like to tell my students, for the rest of our lives and the rest of their careers, every region of the world, particularly Europe, particularly North America, is going to be aging and the population is going to be shrinking. Even India's population is beginning to plateau. Africa is the only place where this really isn't likely to happen for a while. And to give you a sense, many countries in Europe currently have a median age in the 40s. And Uganda's median age is about 15. A little bit of that is because people live longer in Europe and Japan, but a lot of that is just the birth rate. And so as we think about that, I think there's a very pragmatic argument to people thinking about ways in which they can make small changes, which will accumulate and aggregate into much larger changes. And that's really what I'm looking for. I don't think that we can go in and make broad proclamations. In fact, Americans have done that on the African continent for a very long time, and it often hasn't worked very well. I think instead what we need to do is we need, just as Darren said, we need to understand the system. We need to understand the reason why things work the way they do. And ideally, and this is what I want my students to leave the UCT GSB with, I want them to be able to see things that no one else has seen before. My students are always asking me, well, what do you think we should do? And I say, that's not my job. Mm. My job as an educator is not to have the answers to the problems. My job as an educator is to show you what I see, to show you what I know, and to give you the tools that could plausibly equip you to find these challenges and to solve these challenges. And if, you know, beyond being here for Africa, when I wake up in the morning, I go and I talk to students and I teach students because I genuinely believe that those students will go out into the world and do things because of what they learned in my class and in all of the other classes, as well as the lives that they bring into these classrooms, that they will be able to go out and change things that I know I can't figure out. And that's the wonderful thing about being an educator, this optimism that we have about the future and about the young people, and in some cases, not so young people who are passing through our classrooms.
One of the most amazing things about traveling on the continent is you pick up that optimism, right? And it's something in Europe I feel we've lost. There is a gloominess, and it's currently being reinforced by these geopolitics. I come back to what you said before. There was an opportunity. You're beginning to see some change mm-hmm. in the narrative. You know, we have agency here.
It's one of the places, and I mean, this is part of being in a situation which is bad today means that people wake up and say, probably tomorrow or next year will be better than yes. today is. And that's something you see across the African continent, and that is very much not something that you see in the West.
And it's the reverse.
Exactly.
We say that all the time. Our kids will never live the life
that's
that
right.
we're living.
I think Edelman had some data where I think in France it was down to 9% of French respondents who felt that their kids were going to be better off than they are. Yeah. 9%. And if you think about it, if we lose optimism, then everything that requires sort of, you know, deferred compensation, like investing in yourself, going to school, right, working yeah. hard.
What's the point?
Why should I be doing this if things are not going to be better in the future? So let's take a step back, right?
either we can feel beaten down by those challenges or we can rise to the occasion.
So the optimism then isn't just something that is innate. It is actually something that is generated, right? And part of your role as leaders, part of our role as leaders, is actually to see the glasses half full and to encourage particularly the young people who come through our institutions to sense that sense of agency and to realize that the future isn't written and they have a really important role to play.
Don't become jaded too quickly.
Yeah.
there's a quote which I love and I use it every single time. In fact, I use it so often that every time I use it at my school, everybody sort of looks at each other and laughs because I use it every single time I speak, but it's because I love it so much. It's by a Nigerian author named Ben Okri. And it's a longer quote, which I won't go into, but the last part of it is, we can redream this world and make the dream real. And I see that fundamentally as what business schools do. We together can sit down and redream the world, but business schools, unlike almost any other group in the world, can actually equip our students with the skills and the tools and the networks and the ways of thinking to implement, which I think we all know is the hardest thing about doing anything. And so we're not only redreaming the world, but we are actually equipping our students to make the dream real.
I wanted to ask each of you about what you love about the jobs that you have. You lead world-class business schools. So what do you love about doing that? So what do you find the most difficult about these roles?
I mean, I'm happy to share because it's the same answer.
Yeah.
So what I enjoy most, and it's something that's come up from both of us, is actually the impact that you can have on students, even as a dean. And I think a lot of deans, and this is where the struggle is, they get busy and there's challenges and things. You have to come to meetings for GNAM, and you have to talk with alumni and donor. You have so many things you have to do. And sometimes I think we lose sight as deans of where the real value, where the real difference is being made in what we do. And that's with young people, students in a classroom that are looking for direction. And my saying isn't as eloquent as yours, but I love to tell my faculty and my staff is that we change lives. And I think as a dean, you need to be doing that on the front lines. And I've tried to carve out time when I'm in town to just spend time sitting in the back of a classroom or sitting in the student lounge, which seems weird, and just talking with kids. And most of them are just excited, a little bit surprised, but always have an interesting conversation that they want to share. And, you know, if I could give advice to any incoming dean or new dean or old dean, it's take the time to actually get on the ground level with students a bit more. I wish I could do it more. That's probably my biggest regret is I don't really get to teach much. And I have to really block calendar to spend that time.
I would agree. I think the hardest thing about my job is that I feel the opportunity costs acutely. So I do teach. I teach a lot because I love it. And there's this way in which I relax by teaching. And again, it is the most immediate way for me to see the impact that I'm having. On the other hand, there's also a selfish element to it because I teach so many of our students, I have a different relationship with them than I would if I wasn't teaching them. And so when they want to complain about something at the school, they once upon a time might have written me an email, you know, dear, you know, Director Duggan, I am upset about something. But now they just call me up, or they don't call me, but, you know, they'll just knock on my door or they'll send me an email. Hey, Catherine, you know, this thing is happening. I know, and they feel... And I'll share a thing that I find very inspiring, which I actually learned when I was doing a case study on OCP, which is a big mining company in Morocco. They've really totally reorganized their organization in amazing ways. And one of their central organizing sort of themes is what they call NIA. It's an Arabic word, and it means basically giving people the benefit of the doubt. It is a religious term. But it is used in OCP to really describe describe, again, giving people the benefit of the doubt, believing that people are looking to do good. And that, I think, has changed, teaching has changed the way in which most of my students relate to me as dean, because they see what we're trying to do, they see what I'm trying to do, and they will come and tell me, ah, you know, this thing over here is inconsistent, I think, with the direction that you're trying to move the school, rather than saying, I'm really mad because you're not taking X, Y, or Z seriously. And that's, I think, a really important thing. And it, what I tell myself on really long days when I wake up very early to teach and then I go to bed very late because I've had an alumni function, I tell myself that, among other things, I am investing today because this is going not only to make the impact later, but it's even going to make my life a bit easier because I'm not going to get emails in 3 months' time, which will be more problematic. Having said that, I feel these opportunity costs acutely. And I really, really want to be doing everything all the time. And I think one of the things that people don't tell you when you become dean is just the physical and mental toll that it takes and the degree to which...
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, the deans need to take care of themselves. And yet it sounds very... I don't even know
selfish.
What to say. Exactly. I mean,
it sounds
crazy to say, you know, this person, I know CEOs feel the same way. This person at the top needs to take care of him or herself, even though it is very much true.
So on that note, you're a little bit ahead of me in terms of your tenure. So I've been doing this for 9 months. You've been doing it for 3, Darren. You've been doing it for 5, Catherine. Mm-hmm. Both of you driving extraordinary impact. What are a couple of things that you've learned about doing this kind of work that maybe you didn't know 1 year into the job and you wish you had, and you'd be happy to share with somebody who's following you?
I would say, and it goes back to the leader or CEO, I was surprised that I'm more lonely than I was before. And so even people that I would say are, and still are, my friends, the relationship changes. And you're seen as leader, and you have to be a little more careful on the things you say. And both of you know me a little bit. I'm a very, I just like to chat it up. And I've had to be better and be a little more cognizant that when you're at the top, things you say matter, and the relationships and how you manage them are going to change. And it's a bit lonely at times because, you know, people look at you in a different way.
You're the boss.
You're the boss.
Yeah.
So that's one thing that I would say has been interesting to grow on and to develop on.
And that's why these sorts of meetings like the one at GNAM that we're here for are so interesting, because you have a bunch of deans who come together and have a chance to talk to each other. It's actually something that I had no idea I was going to enjoy as much as I do. I know that people see some of these conferences and other things as boondoggles, but actually the opportunity to go regularly to conferences and see other deans over and over and over again has been incredibly valuable, partly because you learn from them.
I think that totally resonates. I think one of the reasons why management education has been so successful globally, why it's perhaps the most globalized, but perhaps also the most respected part of professional education, is because we have these horizontal networks, we learn from one another, we have these gatherings, we have these formal processes.
Absolutely.
The other thing that resonated as well, Darren, is, you know, yeah, it does get a little lonely. And so it's important that we get together. It's a privilege to lead these institutions, but it's also hard. And so spending time with one another and comparing notes and learning from one another makes it easier, helps us be better at our jobs.
A little bit of crying.
And a little bit of that.
A little therapy. It's good for you, man.
Or at least coffee.
There you go. I'm so grateful that you took the time. Thank you so much for sharing your insights.
Thank you. It's so great to talk to you.
Thank you.